Nuketown Radioactive number 62 for Monday, February 25th, 2008. On this edition of Nuketown Radioactive, I struggle to keep my narcoleptic Mac awake, try out movies on demand, start planning my trip to Balticon, spend some time in a secret lair, figure out exactly how to enjoy exercise, take a look at the Savage Worlds wiki, and contemplate why Wizards of the Coast is slashing and burning Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition. Welcome back to Nuketown Radioactive, the occasional podcast about life, liberty, and the pursuit of geekdom. And wow, the last month has been really more about life than anything else. It has been an exceedingly busy month. And, you know, I seem to be saying that an awful lot in the intros to these podcasts, but alas, it's just been one hell of a winter. Fortunately, the start of semester crush at the college where I work is over, and I've been able to ease into some other projects which are a little less insanely demanding, but there's still a lot going on the home front. And one of those projects has been to upgrade my wife's website. We're going to do something with WordPress. So I have been hacking away at various templates, trying to come up with something that she likes. And hopefully by the time the next podcast is up, I'll be able to share the URL with you and ask folks to go check it out, let us know what you think, and post some comments. We're not quite ready yet. We're still kind of on the shakedown cruise, so it'll probably be about another week or so before we're ready to unleash the masses on it. Now, what else has been going on? Well, Sue and I did actually get a weekend to ourselves. I guess it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago at this point. The kids went over to my in-law's house for, I think, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. So we kind of had an extended vacation from the kids, which was, you know, of course we missed them, but it was kind of nice to be grown-ups for a night, grown-ups who didn't have to worry about kids. So what we did was watch a movie. Now, we didn't have any Netflix around, and we weren't really particularly thrilled with the idea of running out to Blockbuster. So instead, we rented a movie through Video on Demand, which is not something we had ever really done before. We don't watch a tremendous amount of movies together, and most of the ones we do get are generally through Netflix. But we thought, hey, you know, we have this service. Why not try it out? So we did, and we got our first film, which was The Bourne Ultimatum, which, you know, if you've watched the Bourne flicks, I think it pretty much continues that trend of cool stunts, lots of action, plot that just kind of seems to be there. You know, it goes for the big reveal at the end, but I was just never that emotionally vested in Bourne and really caring about his particular quest. Maybe it's because he's just, you know, a killing machine. maybe it's the preponderance of action over plot. I don't know. But in any case, you know, it's a fun Saturday movie to watch. When you just want to hang out on the couch, eat some popcorn, and kind of disengage your brain. So my only real complaint about Video on Demand is that it uses PanScan instead of Letterboxd. Now, this is admittedly something of a movie snob kind of thing, but really when I'm watching a movie and when I'm paying to watch a movie, I want to be able to see that in the same aspect ratio that I saw it in the theater. I don't want pan and scan where you're cropping off stuff to the left and right. I want the same movie that I would have seen had I gone to see it in the theater. and this would be an advantage to Apple TV, as far as I can tell, because I believe that the Apple TV stuff is going to be letterboxed. So what can I say? For me, that's enough to not want to do it again. For Sue, probably not. I mean, she didn't think it was a big deal. She really didn't care, but she doesn't spend nearly as much time watching movies as I do. And I guess in a pinch, it works. But, you know, it's just one of those things that just kind of sits there and bugs the bejesus out of me. So overall, good idea, good delivery, but the content, give me the letterboxing, guys. I really, really want the letterboxing. Now, last podcast, I mentioned that I had upgraded to Mac OS X Leopard, and for the most part, I've been pretty satisfied with the upgrade. The one problem I've had is that my MacBook Pro does not like to wake up from sleep. And after I recorded the episode, I went out and started looking for possible solutions to this problem, and I found a couple of things. One of which is just the way that the Mac goes into hibernation when you close the case, and that's primarily the problem, is that it's actually going into hibernation, which is a kind of like a deep sleep mode where it powers everything down, as opposed to just going into a light sleep mode where you can easily wake it back up again when you open the case up. So I found a website called, or an article called, Fixing MacBook Pro Sleep Problems, and this seemed to help a little bit. It did require some mucking about with terminal, but after tweaking the sleep setting via the command line, things were working a little bit better. Now, the other good news is that Apple has just released an update to 10.5, which includes, let me back up for a second. Apple has just released a fix for the MacBook Pros that should hopefully help them wake up better. Apparently, it was ignoring the first keyboard stroke when you woke up the Mac, which would, you know, reflect some of the problems I was having. So between all these different fixes, my Mac does seem to be waking up better. It still likes to go into deep sleep mode more often than not, and in that case, I just have to like pound on the keyboard a little bit and give it a chance to wake up, which usually takes somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to probably 30, 40 seconds, which is just far too long and really annoying, but it's certainly better than things were before. Now, I do want to mention that I've got two conventions I'm going to be going to in the near future. The first is DrupalCon, which is in Boston. It's coming up March 3rd through 6th. And basically, I'm going to be in Boston geeking out and talking about Drupal. There's going to be a couple hundred people there talking about the open source content management system, which, if you're interested, actually powers Nuketown. So I will be really excited to go and check that out, see what is available, see what people are talking about, both for Nuketown and both and for the day job where I work at a college, and we use Drupal for a campus blogging solution. We use it to host a couple of departmental websites. It's really flexible. It really lets you do a lot of different things, and I'm just excited to see, well, just what people are up to. So the other convention that I will be going to this year, which has just got me completely excited, is Balticon. I will be going to Balticon 42, and I will be there on Saturday and Sunday. I don't know if I might be tempted to go down on Friday. A friend of mine is getting a room Friday night, so in theory, I might be able to show up there earlier if I can clear everything with the family. But I know that I will definitely be there Saturday and Sunday. And I'm really excited. A lot of the East Coast geek podcasters and gaming podcasters will be there. Merle Lafferty, I know, will be there. And this is a chance to just, you know, once again, just like going to Gen Con, meet a bunch of people that I've been listening to for years and actually, you know, have a conversation in real time, which is just, well, it's just too damn exciting. And if you can believe it, this is actually going to be my first science fiction convention ever. I've been to Gen Con a number of times. I've been to a bunch of local gaming conventions, but I just never gone to a sci-fi convention. And admittedly, the reason why is because although I'm a big sci-fi fan, I could never really see the reason to go to a sci-fi convention. I mean, I'm sure there's the panels and there's meeting fellow fans and, you know, geeking out at meeting your favorite authors and such. But I guess the latent fanboy in me just isn't strong enough to overwhelm my consciousness and say, you must go to this convention. But the attraction now, of course, is that I have friends who are going to be there. So I think if nothing else, that will probably be the highlight of the con for me. It would be awesome to sneak in a game here or there, although I know the con isn't really about that. And I got to say, I'm really curious as to what the heck you're going to do there, what I'm going to do there. I don't know a lot about the panels that Balticon's going to have. I assume it's like most science fiction conventions with the book discussions and, you know, discussions with creators of series and that kind of stuff. And of course, you know, seminars on, you know, different franchises and such. And I don't know. I'm curious to see if it's fun to go to those kinds of sessions, if it's kind of boring, it's a little bit of both. I don't know. I don't know. Part of me is just irrationally skeptical about the whole sci-fi convention thing. I don't know why. I think it's because I'm so used to going to a convention and being an active participant. You know, when you go to a gaming convention, you sit down, you're at a table, and you know for the next 4 hours you're going to be throwing dice, role-playing, and just, you know, having a lot of fun. Whereas, you know, if you're going to a seminar, it seems so passive to just kind of sit there and listen to people talk. Now, admittedly, it may be more interactive than that. There may be more back and forth, and I'm just kind of missing that. But I think that's why my gamer side of my personality is saying, well, you should go to gaming conventions because sci-fi conventions are, well, boring. So we'll see how it goes. This is going to be an interesting little experiment. Another convention that I'm thinking about going to this year because Nathan Lilly at spacewesterns.com has been trying to get me to go for years and years is PhilCon, which is a science fiction convention held in Philadelphia every year. I believe this year it's being held in November. So we'll see. That's a little bit more local to my area. And I think if I really like Balticon, then I think I very well may have to go to PhilCon. It would be hard to argue against it. Now, I will say this, if you're listening to the podcast and you intend to go to PhilCon, or you would be interested in going to PhilCon, well, drop me a line and let me know, because that would give me one more reason to go to the convention.
Chris, you've got the seven sun plants, but you don't have me. You were going to kill me, Chris. You were going to have to come down here. You're going to have to come down here.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you, and I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me, cliffhangered, marooned for all eternity in the center of a waterlogged, forgotten lab. Buried alive. Buried alive.
Chris!
Chris!
The Secret Lair, the final... Oh, come on. You cannot be serious. No, I am not reading that. And what is this? These are the voyages of 230-something Midwestern geeks? Forget it. I'll say subscribe at www.thesecretlair.com, and that's it. I'm done.
So I have a good reason for talking about the Secret Lair again so soon after mentioning it in Nuketown Radioactive 61. First of all, they have a new promo, and, well, of course I had to play the promo, right? The other reason is that I'm actually going to be on an upcoming edition of the show. I'll be in Secret Lair number 6, or at least I think it will be Secret Lair number 6. We're going to be talking about things like using open source tools for gaming, so using Drupal or MediaWiki for your role-playing game campaign, which is kind of cool. Geek Life, the Secret Lair book club, and whether Leopard's worth the cost of an upgrade. So all in all, I had a blast hanging out with the guys. It is an awesome podcast. If you're not listening, you should be. And it was a lot of fun. I really hope to do it again in the near future. And who knows, maybe I could have some guests on Nuketown Radioactive as well. Of course, that means I'd have to actually, you know, figure out how to do the whole audio capture thing from Skype. But, you know, I might know a guy who might know how to do that. So anyway, check out the Secret Lair podcast. I think it was pretty cool. And, well, what can I say that I haven't already said three or four times in the last couple of sentences? Moving on. Can you tell it's been a little while since I did a podcast? This is why I need to get back to doing them every week, because my brain just starts skidding off the rails when I get out of practice. Anyway, I came across an article on Lifehacker not too long ago called 13 Tips for Actually Enjoying Exercise, which I thought was pretty cool. And given that it's been a recurring topic on Nuketown that people seem to resonate with, I thought I'd bring it up here as well. So here are some of the tips that they had. I encourage you to go and check out the full article for everything. But some of the things they suggested were having short workouts. So don't feel that you need to go to the gym and work out for, you know, an hour or 2 hours. You can get away with 15 to 20 minutes. The point is actually doing some exercise. The concept of doing daily challenges. So instead of trying to, meet some huge goal, just meet the goal of going to the gym. Make time for it. So, this ends up being a time for exercise, a time to relax. Use it for stress relief. So the idea is that, you're going to the gym not just to exercise and not just to feel better, but also to decompress. And I think personally, I find that to be definitely one of the biggest motivations for exercising, because despite the fact that I've been going to the gym for a while, I still don't particularly enjoy it. It's not really my thing. Working out on exercise equipment will never probably be my thing. I don't think I will ever go to the gym just for the sake of going to the gym. But going to the gym as a way of relaxing, or as just working off some frustration at work or at home, that actually works. The other thing that they talk about, and I think this is a great point, is rewarding effort but not weight loss. I think some people, they come up with an exercise regime, and they set as their goal, I'm going to lose 20 pounds, or I'm going to lose 30 pounds, or whatever. And honestly, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure there, because you don't know how long it's going to take to lose that weight. You don't know how well your body's going to adjust to losing that weight. I mean, everybody inevitably bounces back, and we're going to be talking about that in a little bit. So the idea is, instead of saying, well, when I lose these 10 pounds, I'm going to buy that printer I've had my eye on, or, when I lose these 20 pounds, I'm getting that iPod Touch. Focus more on, well, when I go to the gym, 4 days a week for 6 months, well, then I'll get the iPod Touch. And, if I go to the gym, 4 days a week for a month, I'm going to get that book I've had my eye on, that kind of thing. And I think that's more productive, and I think it's ultimately more realistic, because honestly, it's easier to get to the gym every day and to exercise and to accomplish, to get that sense of accomplishment of having done something when you're saying, okay, yeah, I want to get to the gym and I want to do this, as opposed to saying, well, geez, I want to lose 10 pounds and I've been doing this every day and I still haven't lost it. Well, that's just kind of puts you into a downward spiral, and it says, I don't have any real reason to go to the gym because this isn't working. But honestly, there's benefits to going to the gym and exercising that are more than just weight loss. Like I say, stress relief is a big thing. Just getting the exercise and, working out a little bit is important, even if you're not losing the weight. So I think this was a good article. I think it's a very positive article. And I think that if you're having some trouble motivating yourself to get to the gym, it's definitely something you should read. Now, I will say that I have had terrible luck getting to the gym since, probably November. I think when I was working on NaNoWriMo, I just kind of got out of the habit of going to the gym. I went down to like once a week or something like that. And after the National Novel Writing Month was over in December, well, then we got into the holidays and sicknesses. And, that just ate up December and January. And now I sit here in February, with most of February gone, thinking to myself, my God, I still haven't gotten to the gym. So, I think I need to take some of my own medicine here and really just kind of figure out a way to make it a priority again. And I've talked about this a bit on Nuketown, and the problem right now really is family stuff, honestly. It's the fact that, by the time Sue's gotten through the day and 5 o'clock rolls around, the kids get a lot to handle, and it's really hard to deal with them right around 5:30 for whatever reason. I think Jordan just can get really, really hyper at that time, and it's really stressful, especially since around that time Sue's usually trying to get dinner together. So that also happened to be my exercise time, and the easiest thing to do was to try and shift my schedule and to just come straight home after work and help Sue with the kids and try to get to the gym later. And I don't know about the rest of you, but trying to get to the gym at 8 o'clock is just a near impossibility for me. I cannot get that motivated. Once I'm home, I kind of want to stay home. So I'm trying to reset my goals and try and come up with something a bit more realistic. So if I can get to the gym twice a week between now and when spring finally gets here, and Sue can let the kids run outside and run amok through the afternoon, which usually works great for everyone, I think that would be good. I think that would be enough. So on a more geeky note, I have been on a really big Savage Worlds kick for the last couple of months, and my friends and I are gearing up for a weird pulp game that we're going to be running using the Savage World rules, and this, of course, has put me onto a quest for all things Savage Worlds related, Twitch has in turn led me to Savagepedia, the unofficial Savage Worlds wiki, which you can find at savagepedia.wikispaces.com. Link, of course, will be in the show notes. There are dozens of character conversions, including Firefly, DC Heroes, Dresden Files. It has complete lists of official edges and hindrances from every book that Great White Games has published. It has house rules, it has index of monsters, it has dozens of new monsters. So I think it's just a really good place to go when you're working on a campaign and want to see, well, does this particular edge exist? Or, you know, I could really use a giant crocodile. I wonder if they've got stats for that somewhere. So once again, check it out at savagepedia.wikispaces.com.
You should be listening to Onboard Games, where they discuss cruise ship activities and...
No, Biff. They don't talk about that. They discuss...
Pirate games of all kinds. They're like the mob of the sea, you know? Avast, you land lubbers.
No, I mean, they've talked about pirate games, but that's not all they talk about. They cover...
Who would want to discuss boring games?
No. It's Onboard Games. It's a podcast about the board gaming hobby that includes reviews, convention reports, and game design discussions. And while they've reviewed games that pack 15 minutes of fun into 2 hours, and pirate games, it's not the only things they talk about. And they've never talked about cruise ship activities.
Oh, I'm sorry I'm late. I was doing research on games made out of wooden planks, so we can do this Onboard Games promo.
That's it. I am so out of here. I'm going back to the Wandering Geek Podcast and get the next episode ready. You guys are on your own.
I thought he'd never leave.
Indeed. Shall we continue?
Sure. You get us rolling, big guy.
Thank you. For entertaining and informative discussions of the board gaming hobby, you should be listening to...
On Board Games!
With Eric, Don, and Scott.
How I do enjoy their game reviews.
I like the Origins stuff better.
Really? I'm looking forward to the Gen Con debrief.
You can find it over on www.onboardgames.net.
So earlier this month, I posted an essay entitled Why Wizards of the Coast is Slashing and Burning Dungeons & Dragons to Nuketown, and it's gotten a fair amount of traffic, so I thought I'd include it in the podcast as well. Enjoy. Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition is coming, slashing and burning all that has come before to create a new game that ignores the tropes of classic sword and sorcery in order to embrace the always-on, always-cool mechanics of digital fantasy. We see it at every turn, the lack of a 3.0 to 4.0 conversion guide, the admonishment to wrap up old campaigns in favor of 4E, the impending decimation of the Forgotten Realms, and the planned 100-year leap forward in its timeline. Succumba are now devils. Devils are fallen angels. Gnomes are monsters. Tieflings are cool. Evil elves worship Grumash, formerly god of the orcs. Warlocks are the new baseline of character power. Wizards isn't just burning their bridges, they're annihilating them. Now, during the 2nd edition to 3rd edition conversion, Wizards of the Coast was concerned about retaining the core of Dungeons & Dragons while fixing what was fundamentally broken about the earlier edition. With the 4th edition of D&D, Wizards seems more interested in retaining the core of an entirely different game, namely Worlds of Warcraft. Level progressions are fast, with characters going from level 1 to level 30 in the same time it used to go from 1 to 20. Characters gain abilities at every level, and their powers are designed to be used in every combat, resetting between engagements. By level 30, characters will be able to, indeed are expected to, fight gods. And the elves have sideburns. So for longtime fans, the question is, why? Why is Wizards going out of their way to alienate their fanbase, mocking old standbys like the gnome, dismissing earlier incarnations of the game, and making it practically impossible to upgrade existing campaigns, and all the while playing up the elite tiefling warlocks? I think there's two answers. Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 and demographics. First, Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 is an incremental edition. Its usefulness will be endlessly debated amongst D&D geeks, but I think we can all agree that it killed any hope of Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition being an evolutionary upgrade. With the last revision of the rules only a few years in the past, D&D 4th edition can't be about tweaking what was broken in the previous release. It must be a major, revolutionary change, or people won't have a compelling reason to start buying yet another set of new books. While 4th edition will undoubtedly retain certain core mechanics of the game, e.g. you're going to roll a d20, you're going to have fighters, you're going to have clerics, you're going to have wizards, you're still going to have to make some sort of saving throw. Large swaths of the game are being changed. It won't be compatible with what's come before, ensuring that diehard fans will need to buy all the new books to keep their new games running. Second, demographics. The average age of the D&D gamer has been creeping upwards since 3rd edition was released. In my gaming group, the average age is about 35, where it was likely 29 when the 3.0 came out. I'm willing to bet that we're not unique in that. Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro aren't stupid. People in their 30s do not have a huge amount of disposable income or time. In a few years, these 30-somethings are going to be 40-somethings, who may well give up the game entirely. Wizards of the Coast has benefited about as much as it can from a generation that cut its teeth on Lord of the Rings and Tales of the Dying Earth. In many ways, the Lord of the Rings movies are a capstone for our era of fantasy. The torch is being passed to a new style of fantasy inspired by games such as Final Fantasy, World of Warcraft, Elder Scrolls, and EverQuest. Since the new edition is going to need a radical change of the rules anyway, why not do it in such a way that appeals to younger demographic at the same time, especially if you can compete directly with Warcraft and maybe lure back some of those millions of lost gamers? The big question is, will it work? I think Wizards can count on a certain amount of inertia. Some people, maybe even a majority of the current player base, will upgrade simply because that's what you do. They play D&D, and they will keep playing whatever the current rule set is. I think Wizards is alienating a significant majority of their players by changing the default setting as much as they are, and making it harder to run a more traditional fantasy game like Greyhawk or even Forgotten Realms. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that 30% of their players don't upgrade at all. Will D&D 4E lure back enough of the lost MMO players to replace the lost traditionalists? Maybe. Particularly if the online offerings associated with D&D 4th edition prove to be compelling enough. I think there's a good number of Warcraft players out there who are in the game simply because they can't find a local game of Dungeons & Dragons, and if they can do it all over the net, well, they might come back. Ultimately, though, I think Wizards is making a mistake and radically underestimating how much their players like a traditional fantasy setting. In my opinion, it would have been better to release a Flavortext Lite edition of the Player's Handbook, making it a toolkit-style release like D20 Modern or Savage Worlds Explorers edition, and then releasing all their two cool creations as a standalone campaign setting, rather than trying to shove those changes down the collective throats of their fanbase.
Are your players unfocused? Do you have nothing planned? Don't know what to do?
Maybe we can help.
TheGameMasterShow.com.
That'll do it for this edition of Nuketown Radioactive. As always, I'm looking for feedback, so you can send it to me by sending me an email at nuketown@gmail.com. You can also reach me on Skype. My username is Nuketown, and you can follow along with what I'm doing on a daily basis by checking out my Twitter account, which is available at www.twitter.com/NukeHavoc. And of course, links to all this good stuff is in the show notes.